The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
From the corner of Merrick Avenue and Sunrise Highway in beautiful Merrick, Long Island, New York, this is Long Island's WGBB Sports Talk New York. 95.9 FM, 1240 AM on your dial. I'm your host, Mike Wadone. Joined, as always, by the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. The number is 516-623-1240. Again, that's 516-623-1240. Cap, welcome back. Tonight's kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly we're going to talk about, but the good is something really good that we're going to get to right now.
Yeah, New York sports talk, and tonight we're going to have a Hall of Fame elect talk to us about his MLB career, so I think that's going to be fun.
Absolutely. So this gentleman is a five-time All-Star, four-time Silver Slugger, 2000 National League MVP, all-time leader in home runs among second basemen, and only the only second baseman to have 100 or more RBIs in six consecutive seasons. And now, as you mentioned, Cap, we can call him Hall of Famer. And let's welcome to the program Mr. Jeff Kent. Mr. Jeff Kent, welcome to our program, and thank you so much for being here, and congratulations on the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm starting to get out of the clouds now. I'm starting to see reality. It's been quite a ride for the last week and a half or so.
Well, no one can blame you for that because, I mean, when you're talking the pinnacle of any career, but especially in baseball and professional sports, Hall of Fame is an amazing accomplishment, but very well deserved. And I know you spoke with Chris earlier. We're going to get to a lot of the things that you guys talked about a little bit, but we can tell you certainly while your tenure here in New York wasn't all that long, as two Met fans who were speaking with you tonight, we certainly appreciate what you did here and appreciate you being on with us once again.
Yeah, you know, my Mets career, I hold it pretty tight because that was the first team that really gave me a shot. In 92, when I got there from the Blue Jays, you know, the team was kind of, they wrote a book, the worst team money could buy. So I was a part of that disaster in 92. And in 93, 94 was the strike, I believe.
Yep,
so
yeah.
That was crazy. And then, you know, we went through two general managers and two managers in a 4.5 year period in New York. So it was a crazy time, but I learned a heck of a lot playing in New York.
Once again, we're talking with Jeff Kent. Jeff, 2026 Contemporary Baseball Era Committee. They call you and tell you, you know, that you're going to make the Hall of Fame. So before we get into where you started, let's get to where we are now. Can you talk about, I guess it's just a couple of weeks now, you're sitting around and you know that there's like this extra vote that's out there. You didn't get voted in after 10 years, only hit a maximum of 46.5%. Can you talk about that day and if you had a clue whether or not you were going to get into the Hall of Fame and what it was like for you and your family?
You know, I didn't. I kind of moved on. You know, when I was eligible, they had taken the time that you could spend on the All-Star or the Hall of Fame ballot from 15 years down to 10. And that was just after I retired. So I knew that I had a limited amount of time to be on a ballot to try to make a case for my career, to make the case. You know, for me, I never played for individual accolades. I always wanted to be a World Series champion and needed a bunch of guys to do that. So for me, you know, even the MVP award when I won back in 2000 wasn't, you know, was a great thing, but it just didn't mean a whole lot to me at the time. So you know, fast forward to the Hall of Fame voting, I knew that the percentages, you know, the math just wasn't in my favor. So during that whole 10-year process, I kind of came to the realization that, you know, it just wasn't going to happen. I was okay with it. You know, a lot of people said I ought to be in the Hall of Fame. I was deserving, blah, blah, blah. And so I kind of moved on. I had left, and I didn't really understand the dynamic behind the, you know, I call it the Veterans Committee. But I didn't understand the dynamic behind when the vote was going to happen, who was going to be on the committee voting. You know, my agent, Jeff Klein, out there in New York, he was. But, you know, and I kind of just pushed it all onto him, brushed it all off, and said, hey, you know, if this is serious, let me know. And And Jeff's such a good guy. He left me alone, and I was out hunting and fishing with my family at the ranch with some other folks that had come in from Utah, and I let it go. So that day evolved so fast. Got the call about a half an hour before the announcement, and I was overwhelmed because I was not waiting for the call. We were cooking dinner at 6 o'clock when I got the call. I had 15 people trying to sit down at the tables. Hard enough to corral that many people plus grandkids. So, you know, it was a moment that just took me by complete surprise.
Can you finish that story a little bit? I heard a little bit that you told your wife, and you know, you're not a big phone person, and then your son saw you, and eventually they didn't know until they saw it on MLB Network. Is that correct?
Yeah, if you want to hear the story. So we were cooking, my wife had made spaghetti dinner, so I was in charge of cooking the garlic toast. And, you know, guys, we always burn the dang garlic toast. And my phone is set up that if you call and the phone number is not in my contact list, my phone won't ring. So I put the toast, just true story, I put the toast in the oven, and I grabbed my phone to look at the timer on my phone, to set a timer. And I said, hey, I told my wife, who was leaning over, messing with one of our grandkids, I said, somebody's calling me right now. Who the heck is it? So I said, hello, and it was Jane Clark from the Hall of Fame, who's awesome, who's so sweet. And she said, this is Jeff, this is Jane from the Hall of Fame, and I hit the floor. I grabbed my wife, I pulled her aside because there was so much racket going on in the kitchen. My grandson was crying over there in the corner. You could hear him, you know, louder than all get out. So, and then Jane had told me I entered the Hall of Fame. My wife, because I had gotten to tears a little bit, thought somebody had died. So she was half listening to my conversation on the phone, and I was holding on to her to kind of hold me up because I couldn't believe this was happening. And then Jane had mentioned to me, hey, you can't tell anybody. You know, we're going to make the announcement in half an hour. So I like surprises. So it was, I grabbed a rag and wiped my face and went outside. I left my family inside and I tried to calm down a little bit. And I did not tell anybody. So I came inside, put the TV on. We went and sat at the table to eat dinner. And all my family's looking at me at the end of the table going, what's your problem? Because I had my phone in my hand, and I don't ever eat with my phone in my hand. And they're looking at me like, what are you doing? And my wife said, well, the Hall of Fame votes tonight. So we hurried up and ate dinner, and we didn't tell anybody, and then we got up, went in the living room, and then watched the announcement.
Once again, as we mentioned before, Jeff Kent, who is going into the Hall of Fame in July here in New York, up in Cooperstown. Jeff, that story would be hard to believe if you weren't telling it yourself, because the fact that you looked at your phone and the call was coming in, I mean, that's kind of divine intervention, don't you think?
Oh, it was, and let me tell you, that was Jane's second call, because she had called the first time, and I have this Apple thing. I don't even know how it really exists, but I have this Apple thing where you call, and in the answer machine, which is Apple or whatever, it tells you have to announce yourself and why you're calling, and then maybe we'll ring through to Jeff.
But yeah.
So she hung up. She told me she hung up the first time, and then told everybody that was around her, said, "Hey, Jeff's got this thing," and they said, "Well, we'll call back, say who you are." So she called back again. So you're right. It was in the works to happen. I happened to pick it up on the second time she called, and that was special.
Well, it certainly sounds that way, and that's tremendous. We want to kind of go back just, if we could, briefly to when you started playing baseball. Obviously you were a high school player, had a little, from what we can tell and what we'd researched, some interesting times during your high school career. But you played baseball at UC Berkeley. When you were looking to play, on the college level and in high school, was professional baseball a goal of yours, or was it something where, you knew you had talent, you were just looking to see how far you could take it? Where was baseball in your thoughts at that time in your life?
Well, that's a great question, but let me finish that last story. And by the way, I burnt the garlic toast, too.
You did, of course.
Well, you had to eat it, though. Come on.
The garlic toast got burned because the call came in, and I had to walk. I walked away from the kitchen, so the garlic toast got burnt. But getting back to your awesome question is the answer, baseball was a means to an end for me. It was, My dad was a police officer in Southern California, and he couldn't afford for me to go to a big school. So he had made a bet with me that if I were to get a scholarship to go play baseball somewhere, he'd buy me a pickup truck and a Toyota four-wheel drive pickup truck. So, and back in the day, those were only about $4,500, but it cost you about $20,000 to go to school back, $10,000 to $20,000 to go to school back in the day. So,
sure.
So I worked my rear end off to get a scholarship so I could go play college. Basically, so I could get a pickup truck in high school. And I got the scholarship to Cal. I got recruited by a couple schools. Stanford was one of them, and Stanford offered me a scholarship too, but it was too expensive to go to Stanford. Even on a partial scholarship, which Stanford offered and Cal offered, was too. My dad couldn't afford for me to go to Stanford. Mm-hmm. So I went to Cal, and which at the time was one of the best educations you can get in the state of California. I think still is.
Sure.
They were ranked as ninth in the nation when I actually signed with them as a high school kid. So, you know, we didn't have internet back in the day, and I don't know if I would have done anything different because, you know, I'd toot my own horn. I was a pretty smart kid when I was probably more of a smart ass than a smart kid. But
if you're getting into Berkeley and Stanford, you have to be pretty good.
It could write numbers down on a piece of paper. So I was proud to go to Cal, and I went there for 3 years.
So, Jeff, again, this is Chris Caputo and Mike Goudon talking with Jeff Kent. By 1992, so you got drafted by the Toronto Blue Jays 1989. By 1992, AAA became the majors for you, but there really wasn't much time for you on the field until Kelly Gruber got hurt at third base. How was it for you to, number one, try to get on the field, and number two, figure out what position you were going to play? Because you wanted to be a shortstop, you got moved to second base, and at this time, now you're playing third base.
Yeah, so the Blue Jays, prior to getting Roberto Alomar, didn't really have a second baseman. So I had gone in there as the atypical third baseman when I got drafted. Shortstop, I love shortstop, but I kind of knew I wasn't going to play short. All those dudes that played short in the big leagues, they were stinking awesome and fast. And I wasn't fast. You know, I could hit a little bit, but I had a good glove, but I wasn't fast. So they said, okay, we're going to teach you how to play second. And then a year later, they picked up Roberto Alomar, who's a Hall of Famer. They picked up Alomar to play second in Toronto, and so I got blocked in that spot. But the value of what I brought to that team in 92 was I was a utility player because I could play third, short, second, first. And so you're right. I missed Triple-A, got lucky, skipped Triple-A, went from Double-A to the big leagues. And Dave Winfield was my best friend on that team in 92, kind of took me under my wing. And a lot of those older dudes on that team in 92, lost all their names. Candy Maldonado. Mm-hmm. We had Joe Carter. That's what I'm thinking about. Yeah. Joe Carter was out there. Dave Winfield. Those guys kind of took me under their wing and settled me in because I was the only rookie on that team. And what I did is I just played everywhere. Gruber was the guy that got hurt the most, so I played third the most. Played a couple games at second. Played a couple games at first. And showed my utility-ness. And then what happened was, is at the end of the last day of the trade deadline, the Blue Jays traded for David Cone to get me to the Mets. And that's probably where you're going, but that's how I got to the Mets.
Yeah, and that's wound up being good for you in two ways. One, you wound up getting a chance to play for the Mets, and yes. Also, you know, Joe Carter is the reason that you now have a World Series ring, you know, the home run off of Mitch Williams. So you got your ring and you come to the Mets, 1992 to 1996. Really, you know, as you mentioned before, not great. No winning seasons in New York. And eventually you're traded with Jose Vizcaino for Carlos Baerga, to Cleveland. Can you talk a little bit about, one, kind of getting that ring later on, you know, afterwards, you were given the ring, but you didn't get a chance to celebrate. And number two, a little bit about your time in New York, if you have a second.
Well, geez, you know, I would trade that ring that I have in my hand for the 92 Blue Jays just to be there and to be a part of that winning celebration that Joe Carter was a part of. I went home depressed from New York. That was a shambles of a team in 92, and I was a part of it. That was part of me, too. But I went home, and the wife and I couldn't stay with my family and watch the playoffs. We rented a motorhome and took off to Lake Havasu and just hid out in a motorhome and watched the playoffs for 2 weeks. And I watched those guys win, and I was so disappointed that I missed that opportunity. But so grateful that the Mets gave me a shot that I could play every day. You're absolutely right. That's what a player needed, and I needed that. I needed a team to say, Jeff, you're our second baseman. You're going to play every day, and don't screw it up. So I played, and, you know, the Mets, one of the problems that the Mets had, too, is we just had East and West. We didn't have the realignment wasn't made up. We didn't have the three divisions. So because we were so bad before the All-Star break, we already knew it. Well, when we were on the Mets, we weren't going to make the playoffs. Yeah. So your season kind of just sucks the whole year long, and you're just playing so the fans won't boo you. And that was tough, man. That was, the fans in New York were tough, but they wanted winners. And, you know, with the strike, with the two general managers and the two different managers in New York that I played for, Dallas Green was awesome, by the way. That was, I never really found myself. I was trying hard to find a rhythm and find a groove, and it was just really hard to find that. And I, you know, Fred Wilpon was the owner of the team. He was a good guy. He had a couple conversations with me that I remember really well, and he was a motivating factor for me. But the Mets at that time just really weren't settled, and they just didn't make a good push for the future. One year, we had three rookie pitchers on the mound as our starters. So, I mean, that just tells you right there, we weren't going to compete at the level that some of these other teams were. So we suffered, and I suffered. But let me tell you, some of the best learning experiences you have are from suffering. And I had my fair share in New York.
Just one last question about your time in New York. And certainly, you know, I think you hit on a key point there. You know, you were trying to find yourself, and the team was too, was trying to reinvent itself from the late and mid 80s with all the, you know, the players and success they had. There was a reputation at the time that the clubhouse was really, really dysfunctional. Can you confirm nor deny that, just how difficult that clubhouse was? Because there were some major characters in that room, I would assume.
Yeah, with due respect to those guys, they were all individually, they were all good people. Mm-hmm. They some of them were a little crazy, some of them were quiet, some of them were in the middle, but we had personalities galore, yeah, in that locker room. And every single one of them were strong personalities. The most quiet guy that in that locker room was Eddie Murray, yes, when I got there. And I actually lockered to Eddie. And Eddie had more of a personality like I did, which is quiet, do your job. He was a thinker, and he wasn't this overblown personality. But there were so many of them in there, and this was the problem, is when you have that many strong personalities, they didn't coexist very well. They were friends. I mean, there weren't any fights going on, mm-hmm, in the locker room, but they just never really came. It just didn't fit. And right. I was a part of it too. I'm not throwing anybody else under the bus. I'm the first guy to drop onto that bus. You know, I had a strong personality too when I got there as well, and I was trying to stand up for myself and you know, trying to, you know, make a notch in the totem pole, and I felt sometimes I was getting suppressed a little bit, mm-hmm, but that's what players do. That's the dynamic of a player. It's nothing good or bad. That's just the way it is.
Sure.
So there were so many different personalities going on in there that, you know, with respect, I can say, yeah, it was just dysfunctional. And then I remember Dallas Green coming in when he got hired. He put on these 1968 spikes, you know, these old Adidas spikes, and you never saw a manager wear spikes. Dallas Green put his full uniform on. He was wearing spikes, and he walked around that low-ceiling locker room at Shea Stadium, and he ripped us all a new asshole for 2 hours, page after page of just beating the crap out of us about how we sucked and we were unworthy. And then he started going into what I want you to do, and this is the key to all that, is, mm-hmm, he preached head and heart, and no excuses. And he kept preaching that over and over and over again. And but Dallas Green was a big dude, man. His head was about twice as big as mine. His body and shoulders. He carried himself like
imposing figure,
like a man. I don't even like a gladiator. And he was fearless. And he came in there, and I think that's the reason why they brought him in there too, is to whoop some ass, and he did.
So, Jeff, you had a short time in Cleveland. Again, you were traded with Jose Vizcaino for Matt Williams to San Francisco. 1997, why was kind of that, right around 30 years old for you, why was that the time where you took off? Was it Dusty Baker? Was it you?
A couple things. One is I went home to San Francisco.
That's true,
so that's
right.
Where I went to school in Berkeley, number one. So the comfort level was just through the roof. I knew the area. I went to baseball games at Candlestick when I was in college. So I knew the area. I felt my wife was out there, who was a school teacher. She was there. Our kids got to settle down in the Bay Area. So having all of that part of my life settled was a key factor. Two, Dusty Baker was stinking phenomenal. I learned a hell of a lot from the Mets and learned how to be more professional from Dallas. And then when I got to Dusty, that's when it all started to click, because Dusty was a hitting coach. He was a manager, yeah, but Dusty was a hitting guy. And I learned a little from him. I learned a lot from Dusty. And I learned a little from Bobby Bonds, Barry's dad. I learned a lot from Barry, watching Barry. And then what Brian Sabian did is he put together, who I think is working for the Yankees again, but Brian Sabian was smart as a whip. He put together about four or five trades, and Jose and I were one of the best double play combinations in the game, and nobody knew about it. It was quietly talked about, but when Jose and I played in New York, we were awesome together. And Sabian saw this. We got picked up for Matt Williams from Cleveland, and Dusty put together JT Snow, Daryl Hamilton, and a couple other guys. I forget who the third baseman was with us, but a good group of dudes and who fit with Barry, and Dusty pulled us all together, because Dusty's one of the best best abilities that Dusty has is he's able to talk to players on their level rather than his level. Dusty gets down to your level and gets the most out of you as a player. And man, he was pushing all the right buttons for me. Plus I was tired of being just okay. I didn't want to be just good anymore. And Dusty was able to teach me how to go the other way, go to the right center, get that jet stream out at Candlestick Park where the wind was blowing out to right center, and drive the ball out there. And you know, hell, things started to turn around for me. And last thing, the mechanical thing I did too is I can't remember who told me. It might have been myself, but I started to look at Edgar Martinez as a DH and how he hit and some of the things that he did. And I choked up on the bat about a half an inch. I'd never done that before, but I choked up on the bat a half an inch, and I stayed that way, and it worked out for me. I was able to put better wood on the ball, and my batting average started to go up, and that's when it took off.
Well, Jeff, you know, you're known obviously as a power hitter for home runs, but I think going over your stats before you came on, Chris and I looked, you know, your doubles numbers were tremendous, and I think that probably lends itself to what you're saying about choking up on the bat and just putting, you know, as you said, good wood on the ball to make contact and raise your average.
You know, I'm a mechanical guy. I'm a science guy. So I started to figure out that if you're applying, you know, bat angle and ball spin and driving the ball rather than trying to hit the ball over the fence, but drive the ball to the wall, then the home runs will come. I wasn't a guy who hit home runs 15 rows back like Barry. I was a guy who needed every square inch of that wall so I could just hit it right over it and, you know, get a homer. So, but if you look at my whole career, I was always a double guy, but I think when I started to control the bat head more and I started to more consistently hit the sweet spot of the bat on the ball, that ball started to travel a little bit better for me.
So you've mentioned Barry Bonds a couple of times, and even if we take personality outside of it, how difficult was it to be a teammate with Barry Bonds? How would you sum up your relationship?
You know, it wasn't difficult to be a teammate of Barry's, because Barry was similar to me in that he didn't go to dinner with guys. He didn't give hugs to people. Barry was a worker. He came in, he did his job, and he went home. And I was kind of like that too. And I got a bad rap for that for a while too. You know, people called me aloof early in my career, and you know, because I didn't go out beer drinking with the guys at night or go hang out, or you know, I wasn't you know, the jovial guy in the locker room. You know, okay, but you know, what do you want from me? Do you want me to be a good teammate and a player? Well, for me, the player meant the most. And and for me and Barry, yeah, we fought. You know, you get some high strung, high personality guys that are on 100% all the time and don't let up. You're going to get riffed in the locker room, and we got it sometimes. And you know, and sometimes I think, truly, and I'm not knocking the media to try to save myself, but truly I believe the media made a bigger deal of it than it really was, because it's a drama story. Mm-hmm. Barry was a guy that we all understood. We knew what we were going to get every day, and some of my teammates knew what I was going to get too. But sometimes I thought Barry was a little lazy, and I had to fire him up. And the only way you could fire Barry up is to piss him off. So you piss him off with words or stupid comments or whatever it may be, and he'll come out fighting, and he tries to take that personality on the field, and he'll go out and kill somebody. And so, and he did the same thing to me too sometimes. So, you know, I think comment that people have said in the past, maybe even it was Sabian, the general manager, said, these are two bulls that are in the same ring together, and you want them in the ring, but sometimes they're going to bump heads. And you know, me being a rancher out here, yeah, when I got two bulls in the ring, I love them both, and they're both studs, and sometimes they're bumping heads, and I got to go in there and whoop some ass to get them to separate, but that's just the way it is.
Jeff, fast forward to 2025. Did you ever think that you would get in the Hall of Fame before the home run leader and guys like Roger Clemens that, you know, are multi-Cy Young winners?
No, but, you know, but those guys got, you know, those guys got things to answer to.
Right.
But I can
tell
you this, and I'm so glad that I don't have a vote, and I'm so glad that I don't have to have that fight with or that debate. But I can tell you this, those two dudes are some of the best players that ever played the game.
Right.
And, you know, there's a few other ones too. I think Dale Murphy was awesome. I think Don Mattingly was another one. I think for some reason, and I don't know why, baseball's lost a generation of, is going to lose a generation of players, but there's a reason for it, and I'm glad I don't have to have that debate. And I feel sorry for those guys, but you know, I'm proud of the way that I played. I'm proud that you know, I got recognized for some of the things that I did, and you know, but I've said it, and I'll always say it. You know, I learned a lot from Barry, and I hit against Rod. I was a teammate of Rogers too in Houston. Mm. Roger was a gamer like Barry was too. Showed up a little more happy than Barry was, but he showed up, pitched his eight or nine innings, wherever many innings he needed to pitch, and then he left. And then he came back and did the same damn thing again. And that's all we cared about was players. And you know, Barry was one of the best, and I know Roger was too.
Jeff, you finished with the Astros 03-04, you know, Dodgers 05-08, but I want to go back to 2002, Game 6, you're up 5-0 in the 7th inning, and Dusty comes out and takes out Ortiz. Does that haunt you that you never got to finish that game with a win? And you know, how much do you think about that game, of losing that game and then losing Game 7?
You know, so many people ask me, what are your favorite memories of my career? And I'm a half empty guy, so I'm always thinking about the most memorable memories, and they're not positive. And you just brought up one of them. And it's not necessarily Dusty bringing out that guy. It's
right.
Just the fact that we were up winning that game by so many runs. They had duct taped plastic all over our locker rooms during game six. And they had to rip all that stuff down because we ended up losing. And just going in that locker room and hearing just, you know, whimpers in the corner, you know, some guys were crying, some upset, you know, it's just quiet, quiet. And we still had one more game to play. And just disappointing that that day happened. And to this day, I continue to shake my head, and I just can't believe because we were the best team. The Angels won it. They're champions. I don't doubt that. But we were the best team that didn't win, and that is the most disappointing and almost most memorable part of my whole career.
Jeff, I'm sorry, Chris, I asked you that question. I'll make sure to take him. Yeah. I'll take him out back before we leave. No, thank you for not hanging up on that one. No, but you answered it perfectly. I'm sure it's difficult because in your career, so many great things, but to get that close and have that moment, yeah. When you're talking about plastic on your lockers and everything else, you can't get much closer than that. July 26th is going to come up. You're going to be in Cooperstown, New York. Obviously it'll be an emotion-filled day. Is there one player, is there one person in your life that you'll think of first, or is it just going to be one of those days where you'll just kind of think back to everybody that was a part of your life and your baseball career?
When you get me to think about things like that, the tears start coming because, I've always been a hard guy, but when you get old like me now, and I'm approaching 60, you start to look back on the legacy that you've created and you've had in your life. And so for me, looking back, obviously there's so many baseball people that had an impact in my career, but there's no more of an impact than my wife had taking care of our kids, our four kids, the sacrifices that they made for my career, because I played till I was 40 years old. So, you look back and it was a long, long career for me. And I'm grateful that I had a family that dealt with me when I was struggling, dealt with me when I was happy, it just suffered through losses with me, and are here now, to appreciate, the legacy that I left. And so that's the short answer is my family, and that's the easy answer, but yeah. The sacrifices that families make is untold, guys. And that was it for me.
Jeff, going to play a quick game with you. Just give me like quick one sentence, one word answers if you can. Also, your favorite non-baseball activity?
Motocross. Love motocross.
Nice. Favorite teammate throughout the years?
Teammate from Dave Winfield for sure, my rookie year, and JT Snow in the later part of my career.
And best manager or coach?
Yeah, that's Dusty Baker for sure, the best coach in the game.
So lastly is, have you thought about who might be there to induct you, the person next to you that you want to name for you? I mean, you're going to go in as a Giant, let's be honest, but, is there somebody you thought of to put you in?
You're the second person that's asked me that question.
Wow.
And I don't know how to answer it because I really haven't thought about it. I did first, and it's possible. It's possibly a Giants guy, maybe, but then somebody brought up to me somebody the other day, and that was a great answer. And I can't, and I don't know why I'm stumped. You got me stumped on that one. And
he's asking you some tough ones.
Man, I have no idea. I haven't even thought about the speed. I don't want to think about it because it's difficult to think about.
Yep. Well, Jeff, we appreciate your time. It's been nice to think about your days as a player. And I see guys out there like A.J. Pierzynski and stuff like that. They say, why is Jeff Kent not in the Hall of Fame? And when you go back, Jeff, and you look at your numbers, most home runs by a second baseman, 1,500 RBIs, you did well in the postseason. And I think it's just right that eventually certain people sat down and voted you in.
I can't be more grateful. There's no word or no word of gratitude that I could give to the committee who voted me in and thankful that they overwhelmingly saw that I was deserving of this. I can't thank them enough, the Hall of Fame committee, for what they did. It'll be an argument that'll happen for a long time is, why didn't the media see the same thing? Maybe I pissed too many media people off in my day because I know I could be a little pricky too sometimes, but I don't know if people really got to see who I played throughout my whole career, and it's disappointing that happens.
Well, Jeff, you're a former Met, You're a former Giant, but you'll be known as a Hall of Famer for the rest of your life. We congratulate you. We thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's really been a pleasure to have you on. We appreciate your candor. And when we watch in July, we'll certainly, think of this conversation and, just all the best and enjoy that moment and beyond.
Hey, thank you, guys. Thank you for your time, and thanks for continuing to push sports. It's a great thing.
And keep watching your son, too. Caden was drafted by the Yankees in the third round last year, correct?
Yeah. And I'm having to wear a Yankees hat every now and then. So, but I'm trying not to live through him, but he's a good kid.
Well, best of luck to him, too. And thanks again, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Take care. Good luck out there.
Thank you very much. Jeff Kent, Hall of Famer. What a great guy to have on tonight. Great get, Cap. And we'll be back in just a moment with the second half of Sports Talk New York to talk a little bit of Giants and possibly Mets hot stove.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
And welcome back to the second half of WGBB Sports Talk New York. Mike Wadone joined, as always, by Chris Caputo here. Just had a great segment with Hall of Famer to come, Jeff Kent. And we're going to categorize that as the good for tonight.
Yeah.
The bad might be something a little bit later that we finish up with. But unfortunately, we got to kind of talk about the ugly here. And it's not you, A.J. Rovner, but the team that we're going to talk about, the New York Giants. And A.J., we welcome you back to the program. Another tough one out there today for the New York Giants. What can we possibly point towards that is anything to look forward to in the future?
Well, first off, that's a pretty tough guest to follow, and Jeff, future Hall of Famer, that's a great get by you guys, and it was fun to listen to that conversation. But you've seen promise from each of our young guys, like Abdul Carter's really starting to find his own here with a couple sacks since the bye week and all the things that went off the field, and now it seems like he's coming into his own, as I just said. Brian Burns is having a magnificent season. Had a huge play today on that sack force fumble to turn to a Giants touchdown.
Yeah, he's a pro. He's a real pro.
And then also, I know the last 2 weeks haven't been great, but Dart, of course, there's a lot of promise. And Scataboo, and Neighbors coming back next year. Mm-hmm. You just have to try and be hopeful, especially in a year where you're 2-13, and honestly, you're playing next week to ultimately decide who's going to get the first overall pick in the NFL draft.
Yeah, that's going to be tough, AJ, as, no team really roots for their team in the beginning of the season to lose. But I think, once you get to December, there are certain teams that are actually hoping that their team loses. But I think for the Giants, it's just trying to find progress. And every time Jackson Dart gets under center, that's a positive for the New York Giants. But today was kind of tough. The Giants are putting up numbers that are just really, really bad. 33 yards passing, a net of 13 yards. You're at the stadium. Are the fans just frozen, not showing up, booing? Where are we at?
Yeah. I think fans are just apathetic at this point, to be completely honest. They are just so accustomed to showing up and, all right, we lost again. Like, it's nothing new at this point. Kind of like when I used to go to Citi Field, like in the early 2010s, like I'd show up and just, yep, we lost again, same drill every time you go home. I mean, the Giants won one home game last year. They won two home games this year. I mean, that's three home wins in their last, they play 17 home games, so they're, 3-13 at least in their last 16 home games. So I think just apathetic is the correct adjective to use, as fans are so used to it, and I mean, there's so many road fans there. Like when the Vikings won, you could see the whole stadium that was left going skull, which is, of course, the Vikings chant. I mean, it's really been a takeover of other teams and just apathetic Giants fans.
Yeah, it's kind of like the fans have just accepted the fate of this season. It was kind of sealed very early, and you hate to say it's okay that here comes another, you know, semi rebuild, but it is what it is. In your opinion, you know, obviously there was a coaching change made a couple of weeks back. Do you think Joe Shane continues, or is it at the end of the season? Is it a full cleaning of the house and start from scratch? What are your thoughts on that right now?
I would assume that yes, I agree. It's going to be a cleaning of house. I'm not really sure how you could keep someone with 2 wins, you know, 2-13. That's really tough, especially off of last season.
Yeah.
And if you go back to the first year where the Giants made the playoffs, that was a lot of still Dave Gettleman's roster, right? You know, you had Saquon Barkley, you had Daniel Jones, Dexter Lawrence. Those are all guys that the past regime. So as those guys have started to depart, and like Xavier McKinney's an all-pro on the Packers, Saquon Barkley's won a Super Bowl, Daniel Jones was well on his way to the best season of his career. Now it's this new guys like Deontay Banks and Jalen Hyde and Evan Neal. There's so many guys who haven't worked out. I mean, the guy that I really want is Marcus Freeman from Notre Dame. I think he's just such a great-minded coach, and I think Notre Dame got the short end of the stick with not being in a conference, which costed them making the college football playoff. But I'm so impressed with it, the way he talks and his demeanor. I would love him to be the next coach.
Yeah, and I think that talk has now come up. You know, the rumors come out there about him possibly being, you know, a possibility for the Giants. AJ, you know, it just becomes so negative that it just seems like the Giants were in a lot of games this year. They had a chance to win. I know the woulda, couldas, but, like, they were in games. It's not like they're getting blown out. But is it guys just not having the guts to be able to get through something and, you know, make a field goal and make a first down? Or is this roster just so depleted that they're not good enough to win? Because in my opinion, I think after they got to a certain point of being, let's say, 2-6 and, you know, losing I think it was more like that Broncos game. When they lost that Broncos game, I felt like they got to the point where they weren't going to win, and it was like, okay, you know, as you say, the complacency. But have guys quit on this team?
I think, honestly, it just comes down to coaching. Players have to play, right? I mean, this is their livelihood. No guys, you want to get the next contract. You want to make money. It's a livelihood for these guys. So, I don't think it's anything yet, but just look around the league, right? Like, Chicago, Ben Johnson, Jacksonville, Liam Cohn, Detroit, Dan Campbell. I mean, you could just go all over the league. Like, just coaching is everything in the NFL. It really is to me. You have to be able to coach. And the demise of the Giants started when they fired Coughlin, and now it's just so many different guys. I mean, of course, there's little plays here and there, like missing extra points with the international kicker and Jude McItemi, or against New Orleans, start just the ball falling out of his hand. You know, that really hurt. And so many close games. Of course, the double-digit lead in Chicago and losing in overtime to the Lions, or the 60-plus yarder by Aubrey in week three. Sorry. So, listen, you just get so...
You get numb.
So accustomed to it.
Yeah.
You really do. You just get so used to it.
AJ, earlier in the season, and this is kind of a theory I have, and I've spoken to a couple people about it, and again, it's based on nothing than just a hunch. But early in the season, Giants played the Broncos, and Sean Payton was very complimentary of the Giants and his relationship. If you're the Giants, do you try anything or make a call to see if there's a possibility to get him to the franchise, to give him the keys and say, hey, look, this is your team now. You have all the power you want, all the power you can get, and kind of go from there, as opposed to maybe going the, and again, maybe it doesn't have to be Sean Payton, but as opposed to going the coordinator route to maybe get someone of a bigger name who's done the job and has some kind of connection to the franchise. I don't want to say Bill Belichick, because that ship sailed many, many years ago. But, you know, a guy like Sean Payton, I it was very interesting to me when he was speaking on the Giants a couple weeks ago.
Right, and also I think you have to bring up the other Sean. That's Sean McVay, a guy that I think is always brought up with the Giants job, kind of linked together.
I'd love him.
Yeah, and both of them, what have they done? They've won. So,
exactly.
And to bring that over to New York would be huge. Just having a guy with a track record that knows how to get there, right? Joe Judge was a new coach. Pat Shermer never won. Ben McAdoo never won. Like, all guys that never won as head coaches, and Dable never won, right? I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So I would love to bring in a guy, as you said, a Payton, a McVay, someone with a proven track record that can really hope and take that next step.
Because you absolutely cannot whiff on this one, because it's just been too long.
Yes. I mean, it's time to get it right. I mean, it's so important. I mean, it's just such a historic franchise, and people love the Giants. Like, when they beat the Eagles to go to 2-4, as you could just see, it really meant something to the fan base to win that game in the fashion that they did. And to think that 10 weeks later, we sit here and they're 2-13. You know, I mean, they're up 20-plus points in Denver. They're 3-, you know, I mean, they're right in it if they win that game. I mean, I talk about on the radio, on my podcast with my partner, Steve, if they win that Denver game, they're right in it. It's a totally different season. Brian Dable's probably still coaching here.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it's a totally different season.
Different flight back from Denver. We had on our Hall of Famer, Jeff Kent. Now we have on our Hall of Fame Giants reporter, A.J. Rovner. A.J., we appreciate all the Giants stuff. You make your time also going in and out of the Long Island Railroad to MSG. Have you worked any of the Knicks games this year?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I've worked close to 10 of them. So I'm definitely very, you know, I know that team like the back of my hand as well. So, I mean, they're really just beat Miami at home. So would have been there tonight if I wasn't at the Giants. So.
Let me just bring something up to you. I mean, people get excited the last couple of years with the Knicks, and, you know, it's been a really long time, but I feel like that NBA Cup win gives the Knicks a little bit of that, you know, they could be serious this year, at least for the East. I don't know what's going to go on in the West. You have some really good teams and some historic numbers from Oklahoma City. But do you feel the vibe at MSG when you're going to those Knicks games this year?
100%. And it's just a build-up of last year. I think it's so cool that that core seven, as I like to call them, all came back, which is McBride, Robinson, and of course the five starters in Towns, Ananobi, Hart, Bridges, and Brunson. Like, those guys all came back, and that's so rare in today's NBA. Like, you just don't get that. So I think just the buzz of bringing all those guys back and then just getting off to such a historic start, 14-2 at home now, and I love that they didn't raise the banner, but winning something like that, just the first time New York's won anything of that nature, you know, since, I guess, to be the winner in the finals of a tournament since 1973, right? I mean, that's when they won the finals. So a lot of people never experienced, like, seeing the Knicks win something at the very end. You know, there's no Atlantic Division trophy. You know, they won that in 2012 when I was a kid. That's the first time I've ever seen the Knicks lift any type of trophy, you know, in my 24-plus years of life. So definitely pretty cool. I mean, same thing for a lot of people, you know, people in their 30s, same drill. You know, people just haven't seen the Knicks raise a trophy. I mean, I guess the Eastern Conference Finals in 94, but you get my point. It's a great, great stepping stone for the Knicks.
Yeah, Mike, I'm into it this year.
Well, yeah, and AJ, you brought up a good point. You know, I was really, I'm older than both of you guys. You know, I'm in my late 50s, and I don't remember the 70s. I certainly 94 was a great time, but I was not a real fan of this NBA Cup early on. It hasn't been around all that long, but I thought it was kind of hokey. And but you know, even taking the Knicks out of the equation, who we were rooting for this year, I think they've done a really, really good job of marketing this, making it something a little extra special. They're actually talking about maybe, you know, bringing it to some college campuses, to some of these great arenas, which I don't know about that. But I think, you know, just winning something midseason that had a little splash to it really was a great thing, and I'm kind of on board with that now.
Yeah, I mean, definitely being able to celebrate winning is something that the New York basketball just hasn't been able to experience very much. I mean, just going back to that point, and I know they let the employees the first game back in Philadelphia take a picture with the NBA Cup trophy, which was cool. You could go up and get a photo with that. You could just see the emotion on just people's faces that it meant something. So I know no banner celebration. They're the first team out of the three that have won it not to do that, which I respect. It's commendable. The Lakers and Bucks both rose one in the 2 years that they won. I hope they don't have the same fate. They were both first-round exits. But I definitely think just the excitement of seeing winning and knowing that you're going to be good and you have one of the best players in the league, it just there's so many foundational pieces around the best player, which just I've never seen as a Knicks fan. You know, we had Melo, but an aging Stoudemire and, you know, Chandler and Felton, like the supporting cast is so good around Brunson. So it really is a fun team. I totally recommend going because the atmosphere is just bar none. It's amazing over there.
516-623-1240 if you want to call in. We're talking with A.J. Rovner. We'll talk about anything. But, yeah, I think, number one, Mike, Knicks have to stay healthy at the right time. If they're going to get hurt, do it now.
Right.
But when you get towards April, I want this team healthy to see what they can do. The Mitchell Robinsons, the Karl Anthony Towns, the, you know, Josh Harts, like, they got to be healthy.
They do, and I mean, they are a little deeper this year, and they certainly have played a little bit more of a bench. But you those main pieces there, you can't, like you said, you can't have those injuries late in the season. You can kind of deal with them now.
Especially with, like, the Celtics and the Pacers being on a down.
Right.
You
got to strike.
No Tatum, no Halliburton, such a difference.
Yep.
And even Cleveland has really struggled. I mean, they had a great year last year. There's just something kind of missing with them this year. They haven't been able to put it together. So, and I don't think, you know, Philadelphia, Joel Embiid, he's if you watch him play, the poor guy, whatever you think of him, I mean, he can still score on a semi-regular basis, but he's got nothing left. And who else is really, you know, Milwaukee could get hot, but they have their own drama.
Yeah, the two teams I could see contending with the Knicks is Detroit, of course. They're the one seed with Cunningham. They're a young, really fun team, feisty. And then the Orlando Magic, led by Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner.
Yeah.
So I think those are the two teams that could really give the Knicks a little trouble. But I mean, the bottom of the Eastern Conference in the NBA is the worst I've ever seen in my lifetime. Like, it's really bad. Like, the teams at the bottom are really, really bad. Like, Washington, Indiana, Brooklyn, Charlotte, like, they're tough watches.
Brooklyn is unwatchable. I mean, at least in Charlotte, you have you know, LaMelo Ball and Con Canupple there, who can give you a little something, but Brooklyn, holy moly, they can't give tickets away down there.
No, I mean, I just don't think it's a very fun place to watch a game, in my opinion. Not because I work at the Garden, I just don't think it's a very enticing venue. That's just me, though.
And the product is bad. So, AJ, while we have you on the phone, we're going to finish with the New York Metropolitans. I figure you could put your two cents into where they're at, where you think they're going to be. Because, honestly, AJ, I really think that the Mets at this point are going in a different direction than what we thought.
100%. I mean, listen, last year they did everything that the fan would want them to do. There's no doubt about it. They re-signed Sean Manaea, they re-signed Jesse Winker, they re-signed Pete Alonso, and they made they got Soto, right? I mean, every single thing that a fan would have wanted happened last offseason.
Except this offseason,
everything from a fan perspective, you didn't want to happen. They traded Brandon Nimmo, who we all thought was going to be a lifelong Met.
Yeah.
We got rid of, you know, our best closer of my lifetime, for sure, probably behind John Franco. That's it.
Yep.
I mean, maybe a Roscoe because he won, but he goes to the World Series champ back-to-back, and you lose the all-time home run leader. So every single thing that you wouldn't have wanted to happen, but they never won. And that's the only thing that gives me a little hope. That core never won. And the Rangers are slowly breaking down their core that never won. So Polanco's a solid hitter. He's clutch. Simeon has a great glove. Like, they're small pieces, but I think every Met fan knows that they have to make a splash to have any chance to contend. But piece by piece, they're giving me a little hope.
There's been a little bit of rumblings that, you know, obviously there was dysfunction in the clubhouse, and you know, Francisco Lindor seems to kind of be at the forefront of a lot of these discussions.
Yeah,
which is surprising to me because I mean, again, I don't know him from Adam, but he seems like a at least an upbeat, decent kind of guy.
With the fans, he is, but I think in the clubhouse, I think there was a lot of dissension. You know, with him and McNeil, and him and Soto.
Apparently, another rumor is his wife.
Oh boy,
his wife and Nimmo's wife went at it a little bit too over some politics.
Some of the stuff you read on Facebook is fake. But yeah. I think the Mets are just in a tough spot, and it's almost like a semi-rebuild at this point if you don't go out and make a big splash in the next 2 weeks.
100%. And first off, to go off that point, of course, you know, not getting too deep into politics, but both wives are extremely outspoken about it. You know, Nimmo's way Republican and Lindor's, you know, very Democratic, so that could definitely cause tension in today's age, especially with how outspoken they both are. But you remember the fight with McNeil as well. I mean, I love Lindor. He's my all-time favorite Met behind Wright, so it would really bother me if they got rid of him. I wouldn't know any sense of direction they're going if they got rid of him. Is that a, you know, out of Diaz, Alonso, and Nimmo, he's by far our best player out of those four, in my opinion, just at the age and what he could do being a five-tool player. But there has to be a splash, you know, a Bellinger, a Tucker, something's got to give, or it's going to be tough. It's not going to be fun.
And it's going to be on the pitching. I'd love to see them get Mason Miller and put him in with some of the young guys, but we'll have to see over time. I think it's going to take a little time because you got to remember, a year from now, there's probably going to be a stoppage because nobody wants a salary cap.
Well, I think that's what the whole lockout's going to be, and I think that, honestly, we might not see baseball next year because of it. It's such a top-heavy financial, you know, league, and that's just how it is. There's no cap, and the Dodgers, with just deferring money, they'll just get better and better and better and better every year. They have endless amounts of money, and players want to go there, and they'll win. So
yeah, definitely.
That's just what it comes down to.
Something's got to give. AJ, thanks again for joining us.
AJ,
we really appreciate it. Thanks again also to Jeff Kent, future Hall of Famer in about 6 months. Brian Gray's behind the glass. Thanks so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy Christmas. Happy holidays to everybody. And we'll see you in the new year, and hopefully it's a bigger and better year. Cap, thanks for everything.
Thanks, Mike.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
This is WGBB AM 1240 and W240 DFFM 95.9 Freeport, New York.